and he wanted permission to detach the Second Guards Army from the Stalingrad front and move it at all possible speed to a blocking position in front of the German panzers. Stalin's immediate reaction was violent. He refused to go along with the proposal and assailed Vasilevsky for trying to pry troops loose from Rokossovsky without first checking with Stavka in Moscow. Stalin warned him that he was holding him personally responsible. In return, Vasilevsky was incensed, for he knew it was his duty to maintain the security of both fronts. His anger served no purpose. Stalin told him his request would be discussed that night at the Defense Committee meeting and rudely hung up. At 5 a.m. the next morning, Stalin called back. He now agreed fully with Vasilevsky's plan. The Second Guards Army was alerted for a forced march. The decision came none too soon. At 8 a.m. on December 13th, bleary-eyed German tank crews crossed the Aksai River on a rickety bridge. Now only the frozen Mishkova River remained as a natural barrier to the Kessel around Stalingrad. Desperate to keep abreast of the relief forces' progress at Gumrak Airfield, Paulus ordered 10 radio operators to monitor every wavelength for messages from the oncoming panzers. But Russian technicians constantly foiled their efforts by jamming channels and broadcasting false information. While Paulus lingered in this limbo, he also had to contend with pressures on every sector of the Kessel. In the ruins of Stalingrad, the Soviet 62nd Army denied its own weaknesses and harassed the Germans from the tractor factory to the Tsaritsa Gorge. These aggressive tactics were totally consistent with Chuikov's military philosophy. The combative general knew of no other way to wage war. From her home in Kuibyshev, Chuikov's wife had written recently and reminded him of that trait. "My dear Vasily, I at times imagine you have entered into single combat with Hitler. I know you for 20 years. I know your strengths. It's hard to imagine that someone like Adolf could get the better of you. This could not happen. One old lady, a neighbor, meets me every morning and says, 'I pray to God for Vasily Ivanovich.'" Though beset by supply problems and disgusted with the front command for not sending enough ammunition, Chuikov continued to mount small attacks against the increasingly weary Germans. One of his storm groups concentrated on the potato cellar that Lieutenant Wilhelm Kreiser had held since late October. While his exhausted men slept at their guns, the Russians crawled up, then drove them outside, back to the system of trenches that Kreiser had thoughtfully prepared for just such an emergency. Kreiser rallied his men to counterattack, but he forgot to keep low. From a nearby cottage, a Russian machine gunner put one bullet in his left shoulder, another through his arm. The lieutenant went down into the snow. Still conscious, he gave command of the company to another lieutenant and then staggered off to the rear. In minutes, his successor followed him there, with a bullet through his own arm. Kreiser radioed for reinforcements, then led a group of wounded to an aid station, where a doctor jabbed him with morphine and put him on a sled. Towed further to the rear by a heavy laborer, the drowsy Kreiser fell asleep and rolled off into the road. When the loyal heavy came back and dragged him from a snowbank, the grateful lieutenant mumbled his thanks and fell unconscious. In the days to come, Kreiser would be one of the fortunate men flown out of the Kessel. That night, another Soviet storm group crossed the German lines. Faulty Soviet intelligence reports had pinpointed General Paulus' command bunker within the city limits, and the blonde sniper Tanya Chernova and three other Russians had been sent to kill him. Carefully picking their way past mountains of rubble, the execution squad looked for German sentries outlined against the snow. Tanya was trying to control her temper because the girl ahead of her blundered frequently and made too much noise. "That cow," Tanya thought as she looked at the plump figure that increasingly annoyed her. The cow stumbled, and a fiery explosion smashed Tanya to the pavement. Unconscious, she bled into the gutter from a gaping wound in her stomach. Moments later, Vasily Zaitsev hurried to her side and tenderly lifted her limp form. Zaitsev struggled back to his lines, to a cellar hospital where doctors worked desperately to staunch the flow of blood from Tanya's wounds. For hours they despaired of saving her, but by morning she rallied, and the surgeons made plans to transport her across the Volga for a major operation. After Tanya regained consciousness, her first questions were about what had happened to her patrol. Told that the woman ahead of her had stepped on a mine but survived with only superficial injuries, she listened to the details with mixed emotions. Her vendetta with the Germans was ended. She had broken 80 sticks in her 3 months of war, but the image of that damned cow kept intruding on her thoughts and made her furious. On the morning of December 14th, the German 6th Panzer Division charged ahead toward the Kessel and ran directly into Russian reinforcements of almost 300 tanks. One platoon of panzers was chased by 40 Russian T-34s, and an armored battery, which went to their rescue, came over a low rise to find the Russian tanks barely 1,000 meters away. Painted white, just like the Germans, with black numbers on the turrets, they were surrounded by a large knot of soldiers. For a moment, Lieutenant Horst Scheibert wondered whether he had stumbled on elements of the German 23rd Panzer Division that was providing support for 6th Division's drive to the pocket. Everything looked so German. Then he noticed that the gun barrels seemed more stubby, and the turrets had no domes. Still hesitant and nervous, he moved his force closer. At 600 meters, he had not made up his mind to shoot. He trembled as the distance closed rapidly. Suddenly, the soldiers ahead jumped for their own tanks, and Scheibert only had time to scream, "Achtung!" into the radio before two Russian tanks came at him. Scheibert hollered again, "Fire, Russians!" But the enemy got off the first shots. At only 300 meters, they missed completely. German gunners were more accurate. The first two Russian tanks blew up violently, and the rest was child's play. Reloading with tremendous speed, the Germans slammed shells through the confused enemy formation. 32 curling black pillars of smoke marked the total destruction of one of the Soviet tank columns outside Verkhnekumsky. But other Russian armored groups still controlled the town. The Germans could not yet break through toward the Mishkova River. While grenadiers of the 6th Panzer Division probed for a weak spot in the Russian defense, they heard and saw the Junker and Heinkel transports streaming through the sky toward Pitomnik airfield as the Luftwaffe tried to sustain life in the Kessel. Paulus's tirade against Martin Fiebig on December 11th had resulted in increasing the air shipments to Stalingrad by 50 tons a day. Still, it was not nearly enough. The fault could not be charged solely to the German pilots, whose varied problems defied solution. Russian fighters and aircraft were taking an even greater toll of transports, but the most exasperating worry was the weather of southern Russia. A fulcrum for colliding maritime and continental fronts, it frustrated countless forecasts. Aircraft expecting good weather at Pitomnik frequently encountered low clouds, fog, or even blizzards that forced detours to bases hundreds of miles away. When that happened, both the cargoes and planes were lost to the Stalingrad shuttle for several days at a time. To counteract such failures, meteorologists tried to rely on eyewitness reports from observers inside the Kessel, but these men often failed to broadcast. There was no fuel to power the generators for their radios. A more deadly foe was ice. It tore up engines and immobilized planes for weeks, forcing mechanics to cannibalize parts from wrecks to repair damaged motors. And the mechanics themselves had to overcome unexpected hazards. When they removed their gloves to make delicate adjustments on equipment, their fingers froze to the metal. Maintenance that should have been accomplished was left undone, with catastrophic results. Human error led to another series of mishaps. Since the Luftwaffe refused to allow army quartermasters to supervise the loading of the transports going to Stalingrad, famished soldiers at Pitomnik frequently opened crates of utterly worthless goods. One day it was thousands of protective cellophane covers for hand grenades, but no hand grenades. Another time it was 4 tons of marjoram and pepper, at a time when troops were killing mice and eating them. Again, several thousand right shoes. Most ironic of all was a shipment of millions of neatly packaged contraceptives. While airmen braved death to carry such unusual supplies to the Kessel, the Germans in Stalingrad scrounged for protein. 31-year-old Corporal Heinz Neist met an officer, Lieutenant Till, who smiled mischievously and asked, "Want something to eat?" Nyst gratefully accepted the offer and sat down before an aluminum plate that was loaded with potatoes, meat, and gravy. When he looked warily at the feast, Till grinned. Believe me, it is not a human being. Nyst needed no further urging and ate everything in front of him. The meat tasted just like veal, and only when he finished did he ask what it was. Till told him it was the last of the Doberman pinchers. Nyst could not have cared less. His stomach was full for the first time in weeks. In his snow hole at the edge of No Man's Land, Private Eckhart Brunert could not imagine such a meal. His clothes had frozen to his body, but his worst complaint was about his stomach. It doubled him over with knife-like pains. His main meal each day was a watery soup. More was out of the question, because whenever he held out his mess tin, his name was recorded to prevent him from getting a second helping. What really made him furious was the sight of sergeants eating from plates heaped with solid food. Afraid to speak out about the privileges of rank, the private began to wonder whether everyone in the pocket really depended on each other for survival. Like thousands of others, he foraged for extra food where he could. Once, the head of a frozen horse provided brains for a delicious meal. Another time, a roll of medicine tablets helped assuage his hunger. Given a break from frontline duty, he went to the rear to seek warmth and rest. Within hours, however, he faced an arms inspection. Never having been issued proper lubricants, Brunert frantically scratched and rubbed his weapon with scissors, stones, even his fingernails, until most of the rust disappeared. But the senior corporal who inspected Brunert's platoon used a carefully sharpened match to pry into each rifle. Disgusted with the results, he promptly placed Brunert and the others on extra guard duty. Walking his post that night, Brunert had barely enough strength to stand. His legs felt like rubber, and he feared the extra workload would finish him. 45 miles south of the Kessel, at the village of Verkhnekumsky, the 6th Panzer Division was still unable to push through Russian opposition. The northern and eastern horizons were filled with Soviet T-34 tanks and anti-tank guns that poured a fountain of projectiles at the Germans. It was like a gun duel on the ocean, but here the snowfields assumed a crazy pattern of tank treads and long black streaks left by exploding shells. In the inevitable confusion of vehicles firing and then moving quickly to new positions, Germans shot at Germans, Russians at Russians. When T-34s entered the village, a frantic German officer radioed, "Request permission to abandon the village." It was not granted. Another formation of panzers invaded the town from the west. By noon, almost all its ammunition was spent. Colonel Hunersdorf appeared in the midst of his weary troops. Leaning out of his tank, he screamed, "You want to be my regiment? Is this what you call attack? I am ashamed of this day." He kept it up, hurling invective on all sides, and his soldiers reacted with cold rage. Some openly questioned his right to tell them how to fight, but Hunersdorf's motive was simply to galvanize his tankers. This he did. His tirade was followed almost immediately by another desperate call for help from the Germans inside Verkhnekumsky. Hunersdorf gave the order to burst into the village at maximum speed, whatever the losses, and 5 companies formed a column with the few tanks carrying armor-piercing shells leading the way. Still furious at Hunersdorf, the panzer crews roared ahead, spraying the fields on both sides with indiscriminate machine gun fire. The unorthodox approach terrified the Russians, who jumped up and ran wildly across the plains. Inside their Mark IVs, the Germans assumed that the Russians thought they were insane. Verkhnekumsky fell easily this time, but within hours, an inexhaustible supply of Russians counterattacked, and Combat Group Hunersdorf had to retreat to the west. Out of ammunition, almost out of fuel, each tank carried a load of wounded that clung desperately to the turrets. The combat group's diary recounted in laconic fashion, "This day was connected with heavy losses." It was also a day of heavy losses for the Russian 87th Guards Division. Jammed into a blocking position south of the Mishkova River as the result of Marshal Vasilevsky's appeal to Stalin, the guards had marched for a day and a half without pause from the Biktavka area, just below Stalingrad. In the vanguard of the division was Sergeant Alexei Petrov, who had just trained a new gun crew for the offensive, and he urged his men to a faster pace. Snow obscured his vision, and exhaustion became the main enemy, but he allowed no one to rest. Petrov himself held onto the barrel of the gun and slept while walking. Finally, they arrived at the Mishkova River, and immediate combat with the 6th Panzer Division around Verkhnekumsky. Petrov had never seen nor heard such heavy shelling. Hour after hour, explosions blew the ground into pillars of frozen dirt and snow, and the horizons blossomed with endless flame. To Petrov, it was worse than in Stalingrad. On the flat plain were thousands of bodies, tossed like broken dolls onto the ground. Most were Russians, victims of German artillery and Stukas. At the height of the bombardment, Petrov saw a tiny figure, no more than 3 feet high, waving his arms wildly. Amazed, Petrov looked more closely and saw that it was the upper body of a Russian soldier. Beside it on the ground lay a pair of legs and hips, neatly severed by a shell burst. The man was looking at Petrov, and his mouth opened and closed, sucking air, trying to communicate one last time. Petrov gaped at the apparition until the arms stopped flailing, the mouth slackened, and the eyes glazed. Somehow, the soldier's torso remained upright and forlorn beside the rest of the body. Chapter 20. Still unsure of the relief force's location, Paulus prepared for the crucial decision of how to link up with Manstein. After assigning the 53rd Mortar Regiment the dangerous job of leading the breakthrough, he moved armored combat groups to the southwestern corner of the pocket, but he could find only 80 tanks fit for action. He also called on Major Josef Linden, whose engineer battalions had been decimated at the Barakati gun factory a few weeks before, for two special assignments. The first was plowing clear the road network around the Kessel, a simple job on the surface, but exceptionally difficult because of the gasoline shortage. The second task was equally vital. Two road construction battalions and a bridge company were needed to deactivate the minefields so that the German tanks and trucks could break out quickly when Paulus gave the word. After 4 days of fighting, Manstein's soldiers were still on the way to Stalingrad, but the attack had slowed to a snail's pace. Combat Group Hunersdorf of the 6th Panzer Division had not yet captured Verkhnekufisky, and supported by part of the battered 23rd Panzer Division, the replenished tankers went back to the village. The drive bogged down again, so the 6th slipped off to the west to outflank the enemy. Around the village of Sogatskot, the Russians had prepared a vast network of rifle pits that made it impossible for tanks to advance. Nor would any of the Russians surrender. From distances of 10 feet or less, the Germans shot into the trenches. The tanks stood like elephants with fully extended trunks, and when the Russians raised their heads, the trunks recoiled and blasted them with point-blank fire. Still, the Russians held. Finally, when Soviet armor came up to help, Combat Group Hunersdorf again had to back away as the twilight of December 16th obscured the land between the Aksai and Mishkova rivers. In Stalingrad, every Russian along the Volga shore heard a tremendous crashing noise, and Vasily Chuikov bolted from his cave to witness a glorious sight. An enormous wave of ice was pushing down past Zaitsevsky Island, smashing everything in its path. It crushed and pulverized small and large ice floes alike and broke logs like matchwood, was how he described it later. And while the general held his breath, the monstrous ice pack slowed and, just opposite Chuikov's fortress bunker, shuddered to a halt. For minutes, it groaned and heaved. Behind it, thousands more chunks of ice slammed into the jam with terrific violence. The bridge held. A short time later, Chuikov sent sappers across the ice to see whether it would support traffic. By 9 p.m., they had returned safely, and he ordered planks to build a highway to the far side. His supply problems were over. Just a few hundred yards west of Chuikov's jubilant cliffside headquarters, Captain Gerhard Münch was faced with his first case of insubordination. It had been triggered by the Führer's Christmas Drive, the annual fundraising campaign for the Nazi Party that reached even into the Kessel. One platoon from Münch's companies refused to make any donations. When he asked the reason, an officer said, "Captain, you will have to see for yourself what is wrong." Münch went to visit the platoon, reduced to 6 men, and inquired about the trouble. The men told him they were no longer prepared to fight. One trooper added, "Captain, I will no longer play the game. We are fed up." Stunned by their attitude, Münch wisely decided to say nothing. He sent the men to the rear and waited beside their machine gun until replacements came to fill the gap. Then he went to his command post, called for the rebels, and told them they could sleep at his quarters that night. In the morning, he shared breakfast with them, and as the group sat on the floor sipping hot coffee, Münch watched them carefully and noticed they seemed a bit more relaxed. Gingerly, he brought up the previous night's difficulty. The rebels answered without hesitation. The underlying cause of their mutiny was a letter from one of the soldiers' wives, who had asked why he was at the front while several of his friends stayed at home. The soldier had been so upset that he had read the letter to his friends. It had driven them into a state of rebellion, as they, too, began to wonder why they had to fight the war for malingerers in Germany. Münch let them talk out their bitterness, then brought them back to reality. "According to martial law, you are liable to punishment," he told them. "You know how refusal to obey an order will be punished. Are you prepared to return to your positions and not desert or do foolish things? Can you promise that?" They answered with a spontaneous chorus of yeses. One soldier went further. "We will fight for you as long as you command the battalion, but if you are wounded or killed, we wish to be free to make our decisions." Münch considered the offer briefly, then chose to compromise. "All right, confirm it by handshake," he replied. "As long as I command the battalion, you will have to fight. Thereafter, you may do what you want." The men shook hands with him on the bargain. Later that day, December 17th, 150 miles to the southwest at Novocherkassk, Erich von Manstein dined with Freiherr von Richthofen. While the two men sipped wine, they ranged over their mutual problems in trying to save the Sixth Army. Richthofen had just lost 2 of his bomber squadrons, which OKW had transferred without notice to another sector. To Richthofen, the move was tantamount to abandoning Sixth Army to its fate. He minced no words when he exclaimed that it was plain murder. He had phoned General Albert Jeschenek back in East Prussia to make that charge, but Jeschenek formally disclaimed all responsibility for the order. Now Richthofen confided this conversation to Manstein. Both men were appalled by the decisions being made from the safety of the Wolf's Lair, more than 1,000 miles away. By the time dinner ended, the two were in agreement. They were like a couple of attendants in a lunatic asylum. After dinner, OKW's decision to transfer the Stukas back to the Upper Don suddenly became clear. Another Russian attack had routed 2 Italian divisions from their positions 50 miles west of Serafimovich. No one yet realized that this was the opening of Stalin's second great attack, aimed at seizing the port city of Rostov and trapping the entire German army in southern Russia. Reports so far were sketchy, but Manstein added what fragmentary information he possessed to his pessimistic appraisal of the future. He was well aware of the disaster the news implied. If the Italian army failed to hold, his German divisions would have to go to their rescue. The result? Sixth Army at Stalingrad would be lost. Overwhelmed by a sense of onrushing catastrophe, the field marshal fixed his attention on the men in the Kessel, whose time for deliverance was at hand. For days, Manstein had bombarded Hitler and General Kurt Zeitzler about the need to issue a Führer order for Operation Donnerschlag, Thunderclap. The order would call for the complete evacuation of the Kessel. It would also mean the mass movement of the Sixth Army across the steppe, during which time the Germans would have to fight the Russians on every flank. No matter how bloody the outcome of this retreat might be, at this stage of the battle, Manstein considered Operation Thunderclap the only practical solution. The airlift had obviously failed. Holt's rescue force could only channel a few days' worth of supplies into the pocket. To date, however, Hitler had agreed only to Operation Winter Storm, the physical link-up of Hoth's forces to resupply the Sixth Army. The Führer still forbade Paulus to withdraw from the Kessel. For Hitler, retreat from Stalingrad was out of the question, and his reasoning was typically arrogant. Too much blood has been spilled there by Germans. When General Zeitzler agreed with Manstein on the need for thunderclap and promised to get approval from Hitler within a matter of hours, Manstein regarded Hitler's agreement as a foregone conclusion. Thus, on December 17th, he briefed his intelligence chief, Major Eismann, on the situation and ordered him to fly into the Kessel to discuss strategy with the Sixth Army chiefs. The next afternoon, Paulus made an inspection tour of the front. It left him extremely depressed, for he saw multiplying evidence of his troops' physical decline. The men moved slowly and were indifferent to commands. Their faces had become pinched, with eyes sunken behind protruding cheekbones. Many just stared into space. Returning to Gumrak, he found Major Eismann and greeted him cordially, as did Arthur Schmidt, who had campaigned with Eismann in France in 1940. Eismann quickly made it clear that Hoth's relief column could only continue its drive for a very limited period. He referred specifically to apparent bad news from the Italian front and warned that Hoth's divisions might have to be shifted away from the drive to the Kessel in order to save that puppet army. Eismann also went on to say that even under optimum conditions, it was doubtful whether Hoth's tanks could advance more than 20 miles beyond the Mishkova River to Buzinovka, where Paulus had hoped to make the link-up. He asked Paulus to extend his own drive another 25 kilometers south. Paulus and Schmidt reaffirmed their intention to break out as soon as possible, but they argued that Operation Winter Storm, the link-up, was not feasible until Sixth Army received enough fuel for its tanks. There was only enough gas for a sortie of 20 kilometers, not nearly enough to reach the 6th Panzer Division at the Mishkova. Under these conditions, it was impossible to extend the drive. Both generals strongly urged that Thunderclap, the plan calling for the withdrawal of the entire 6th Army from the Volga, had to be initiated at the same moment as Winter Storm. Then, the full weight of 6th Army's waning power could be focused at one point. It was the sole hope for the breakout's success. Eismann pressed them about accepting the risks of making the link-up, even on unfavorable terms, but Paulus and Schmidt steadfastly refused to begin Operation Winter Storm without more supplies. Schmidt was particularly stubborn on this point. He called the airlift the chief stumbling block to success. Half in jest, he told Eismann, the army would hold its positions until Easter if it were supplied better. With the situation still unresolved, the meeting adjourned. The discouraged Paulus went to his quarters, where he wrote a letter to his wife, Coca. Never one to burden her with his own troubles, he asked the usual questions about her welfare and that of his children, then closed optimistically. Just now we are having a very hard time indeed, but we'll survive. And after the winter, there is another May to follow. Chapter 21. For several weeks, German signal officers inside the Kessel had been trying to establish a reliable form of voice contact with Manstein, 150 miles to the southwest. Denied regular phone service by Russian cable cutters, they had created a minor technological miracle. At the perimeter of the pocket, they raised a 120-foot-high antenna beacon that linked Gumrak with Novocherkassk by means of a radio telephone combined with an ultra-shortwave decimeter set that could not be monitored by the enemy. Constantly shelled and repaired, the beacon transmitted messages to relay stations installed in German-occupied territory. But one by one, the relays fell to Russian tank columns. The radio telephone link failed, and only a teleprinter remained to record the words produced by the decimeter machine. As the time arrived for Manstein and Paulus to make a final agonizing appraisal of their options, the chattering keys of the teleprinter became their only contact. If the two men had been able to hear each other's voices, certain intonations or inflections might have helped resolve the crisis. But as the situation stood, Major Eismann reported to Manstein that he did not believe Paulus would break out under prevailing conditions, and Manstein could sympathize with Paulus's reasoning. However, Manstein was beginning to wonder whether or not General Schmidt was exerting undue influence on Paulus's decision not to try a breakout without a proper quantity of fuel. To the field marshal, positive action was necessary within hours. Haggling over gasoline supplies was a luxury Sixth Army could not afford, especially since Manstein was being pressured to do something, anything, to save his own left wing. Unable to communicate the emotions of the moment, Paulus stood beside the teleprinter machine in the operation bunker at Gumrock shortly after midnight on December 19th and waited for its impersonal clickety-clack keyboard to begin moving. The machine hummed and leapt into life. "Here, Chief of Staff, Army Group Don, General Schultz." General Paulus answering. "The Field Marshal, Manstein, requests your opinion regarding the following question. What is your estimate of the possibility of a sortie toward the west in the direction of Kalach? It has been ascertained the enemy is consolidating his position vis-à-vis the south front." Confused, Paulus asked, "Consolidation opposite which south front is meant? Opposite South Front 6th Army or Group Haute?" Schultz hastened to clarify. "Opposite South Front 6th Army." Paulus hesitated to give a quick answer. "I will reply by radio." Schultz. "Any further questions?" The teletype operator answered for Paulus. "The general said no and has gone." But Paulus was back shortly with his opinion, sent on to Manstein by wireless. Number 404, 19th December 1942, 01:35 hours. Top secret. To Army Group Don. "Sortie toward the south at present still easier, since Russians vis-a-vis south front of army even less prepared for defense and weaker than in direction Kalach, to the west." Paulus. 45 miles south of the Kessel, the German 17th Panzer Division rushed to position itself on the left flank of the 6th Panzer Division, trying to break through to Paulus. Finally released into action by Hitler, the 17th added the extra firepower needed to break down Russian resistance, and in the early afternoon of December 19th, the German tanks went back to Verkhnekumsky, where hundreds of Red Army men suddenly climbed from their rifle pits and raised their hands in submission. While the tankers waved these prisoners to the rear, the 6th Panzer Division received new orders. "Strike quickly for the bridge at Vasilevska, 15 miles northeast at the Mishkova River." The Stalingrad Kessel, its tanks and artillery readied, was only 25 air miles beyond that town. As early winter darkness intruded, the rejuvenated Germans raced off on an ice-coated road. In front of them, the horizon began to blink with muzzle bursts from concealed Russian artillery emplacements. At Novocherkassk, Erich von Manstein carefully prepared his summation on how 6th Army might be saved. The plea was directed to Adolf Hitler. Teletype, 19th December 42, 14:25 hours. Top secret, Chefsaha. Transmittal by officers only. To Chief of General Staff of the Army for immediate submittal to the Führer. The situation has developed in such a manner that a relief of the 6th Army cannot be expected in the foreseeable future. Because of the shortage of available aircraft, as well as the inclement weather, an air supply and thus the maintenance of the Army are not possible, as was proven during the 4 weeks since the encirclement. The Armored Corps alone evidently cannot clear a channel to the 6th Army, and can far less keep such a channel open. I now believe that a sortie by the 6th Army toward the southwest is the last possibility to save at least the mass of the Army's soldiers and still mobile weapons. The immediate objective of the sortie will be the establishment of contact with the 57th Armored Corps, 6th Panzers, etc., approximately on the Mishkova River. This can only be accomplished by fighting their way free toward the southwest and gradually shifting the entire army in such a manner that section by section of the fortified area in the north is given up as ground is gained in the southwest. It is imperative that, in the course of this operation, the air supply of the army by fighter and fighter-bomber forces is ensured. In case of a further delay, before long, the 57th Armored Corps will be stalled on or north of the Mishkova River, and this would exclude the possibility of a simultaneous attack from within and without. Anyway, prior to assembling for the attack, the 6th Army will need several days for regrouping and refueling. Provisions in the pocket will last until 22nd December. The men already show symptoms of debilitation. According to an army report, the mass of horses cannot be used because they are starved or else have been eaten. Commander-in-Chief of the Army Group Don, von Manstein. Manstein was almost demanding the evacuation of the Kessel and the complete withdrawal from Hitler's passion, the city of Stalingrad. Now less than 40 miles south of the Kessel's perimeter, the 6th Panzer Division was moving across unfamiliar terrain. Rushing ahead recklessly, it had no choice but to run a murderous gauntlet of armor-piercing shells. Tracer bullets reached out from both sides of the road and riddled the buttoned-up tanks. Inside the turrets, crewmen were dazzled by close bursts that flooded the tank interiors with intense light. "Don't stop!" the command echoed through the formation, and the panzers rammed ahead into the night. Finally, they passed through the artillery zone and were cruising steadily into the unknown. Behind them, a swarm of German tanks burned and exploded. Now, the teleprinter linking Manstein and 6th Army began tapping out the words of another conference. 19th December, 42, 1750 hours. Manstein. Are you gentlemen present? Yes, sir. Please give me a brief comment on Report Eismann. Paulus began a meticulous analysis of his options. Case 1, sortie to the south, beyond Buzinovka, with the objective of joining Hoth, is possible only with armored vehicles. We are short of infantry forces, and otherwise, the defense of Stalingrad and Long New Flank are jeopardized. If this solution is chosen, all reserves will leave the fortress. Case 2. Breakthrough without establishing contact with Hoth only in an extreme emergency. Loss of large amounts of material must be accepted. Precondition is previous arrival of sufficient air supplies, provisions, and fuel in order to improve the state of health of the troops prior to the attack. It would facilitate this solution if Hoth should be able to establish contacts temporarily in order to pour in tractors. The infantry divisions at present are practically immobile, and more divisions are becoming so every day because we are compelled to slaughter horses continuously. Case 3. In view of the present situation, further defense depends on supplies and sufficient reinforcements. Supplies so far were absolutely inadequate. At the present supply rate, it will not be possible to hold the fortress much longer. Manstein wanted more precise information. What would be the earliest date on which you could form up for Solution 2, Thunderclap, the complete withdrawal from the Kessel? Preparatory period, 3 to 4 days. How much fuel and provisions are needed? Objective, Mishkova. 1.5 times the normal fuel supply rate. Let Chief Quartermaster Army Group Don figure it out. Reduced rations for about 10 days for 270,000 men. Manstein was finished. Greetings. Do you have any more questions? Paulus had 2 major concerns. First question. May the Corps participate in the deliberation of preparations for Case 2, Thunderclap? Second question. How is the situation with Group Hoth to the south? Manstein was brief. 2-1. Wait for tonight's conversation. 2-2, Haute, the 6th Panzer Division, is attacking and advancing both sides of Verkhne-Kumski. Moments later, the two generals conferred again, as Manstein received permission from East Prussia to give 6th Army a partial clearance for breakout. Hello, Paulus. Everything went all right with 6th Panzer Division today. He gained the Mishkova section. After this conversation, you will receive an order, but I want you to understand that Thunderclap is a possible solution which becomes effective only upon special order. Eismann described the situation there to me, and I am fully aware of the difficulties. If you have any questions regarding the following order, let's talk again tonight. I have nothing else. Paulus wanted to talk. I would like to report briefly on today's situation. Today, there were combat actions with alternating success in the south part of the West Front and on the southwest front. The enemy attacked with 60 to 80 tanks. On this occasion, we observed a completely new tank regiment number 25. Strong enemy air support. Several enemy tanks, which had penetrated our lines, were destroyed behind our front line. In some places, there are minor breakthroughs, which will yet be ironed out. Today's combat actions have temporarily contained the mass of our own tanks and part of the forces of the army, and proven that the enemy in the direction of Kalach, to the west, has particularly strong tank and artillery forces. Today, so far we have destroyed 26 enemy tanks. Paulus gave a grudging tribute to the Luftwaffe. For the first time, air supplies today were adequate. 128 aircraft arrived and brought in 220 tons of supplies. Congratulations to your successful defensive operations. Regards, Manstein. Thank you, sir. Do I get the order now? The teletype could not possibly convey the overwhelming emotion Paulus felt. Right away. Just a minute. The order began to form on the teletype paper. Teletype number 60328. Top secret. Shefsaha. Transmittal by officers only. 19th December, 42. 1800 hours. Order. To 6th Army. 1. 57th Armored Corps, 6th and 17th Panzer Divisions of the 4th Armored Army has defeated the enemy in the area of Verkhne-Kumski and reached Mishkova section. Attack against strong enemy forces in the area of Kamenka and north of this area has started. Severe fighting is still expected in this area. 2. 6th Army will assemble as soon as possible for Operation Wintergewitter. Link up. The objective is to establish contact with 57th Armored Corps with the aim of pouring in supplies. 3. Developments may necessitate an extension of paragraph 2 to a breakthrough by the entire 6th Army with the objective of joining 6th Panzer Division on the Mishkova River. Code word, Thunderclap. In that case, it would also be important to accomplish a fast breakthrough with tanks in order to establish contact for the purpose of bringing in a supply convoy. The army would then advance toward the Mishkova River, covering its flanks, while giving up the fortified area by sections. Under certain circumstances, it may become necessary to immediately follow up Operation Winter Storm, link up, with Operation Thunderclap, withdrawal. On the whole, the army will have to make do with current air supplies without stocking up notable amounts of supplies. It is important that Pitomnik Airfield be kept in operational condition as long as possible. All mobile weapons are to be taken along. These items are therefore to be concentrated in the southwest part at an early date. 4. Prepare for item number 3, breakout, which becomes effective only upon specific order, Thunderclap. 5. Report date and time of attack as under Item 2, Winter Storm Link-Up. HQ Army Group Don, G3 number 0369/42. Top Secret. Chef Saha. Dated 19th December, 42. Von Manstein, Field Marshal General. The order left Paulus and Schmidt totally depressed, having hoped to receive permission to combine Winterstorm and Thunderclap into one mighty operation. They had been told that all they could do was attempt to link up with a rescue force. Once again, salvation had been denied them by Adolf Hitler. Meanwhile, the 6th Panzer Division had begun to make excellent headway toward the Kessel. Their momentum toward the pocket was incredible. The night air was crisp, almost lung-searing in its frigid intensity. The moon rose slowly in a starry sky. Beneath it, the snow seemed to be fluorescent. Even when the panzers lost their way, the Russians no longer contested their passage, and just after 10 p.m., the tankers stopped for a brief rest. Their vehicles were strung out in a long line. Through firing slits on the right side, tankers could see a trail of telephone poles wandering off across the horizon. In front was a low chain of hills, topped by a darkened village. On the other side of the road, there appeared to be a series of tank traps and trenches. Moments after the tanks stopped, Russian soldiers leaped out of these ditches and strolled around them. The Germans inside held their breath. Lieutenant Horst Scheibert first thought his eyes were playing tricks on him. When his gunner whispered that the enemy was fully armed, Scheibert warned him to be quiet, since it was obvious the Russians thought they were among friends. Scheibert fingered his pistol, rummaged under his seat to pick up a hand grenade, and waited. Lounging against the tanks, the Russians joked and laughed up at the Germans, who stood mute in the hatches. Scheibert wondered when they would realize they were not getting any answers. Sweat poured from under his helmet. As the incredible situation continued, Scheibert figured his men could kill the Russians if someone gave the order, but he felt a curious reluctance to murder these innocents on the road. Suddenly, from the hill range in front, a shot rang out. It was followed immediately by a long burst of machine gun fire. As the Russians bolted unscathed into the snow trenches, the German panzers throttled up and roared ahead. Teletype conversation, General Schmidt with General Schultz, 19th December, 42, 2040 to 2110 hours. Here, Schultz. Good evening, Schmidt. Hello, Schultz. Schmidt carried the conversation. 1. Today's combat activities have contained the mass of our tanks and part of the infantry forces in defensive action. Much fuel and ammunition was used up from reserves intended for the thrust. We are certain that the Russian attack will be continued on the 20th. We can only assemble for the attack if our forces are no longer involved in defensive operations. We cannot tell when this will be the case. However, preparations have been made to ensure that the troops can be assembled about 20 hours after they are free. A report can therefore only be made at a later date or shortly before assembly. The earliest date would be 22nd December, provided we have received a sufficient amount of fuel and ammunition by then. We plan to start the attack at dawn. 2. A thrust beyond the Donskaya Tsaritsa River, a stream just above the Mishkova, with infantry forces is not possible without jeopardizing the defense of the fortress. There can only be a brief sortie across the Donskaya Tsaritsa by tank forces, with the tanks being ready to return to the fortress at a moment's notice, as a fire brigade, so to speak. 3. This means that, if Stalingrad is to be defended, the army can only make a breakthrough when it is certain that 57th Corps, 6th Panzer Division, will gain Buzinovka, and is already approaching that area. 4. You will receive our opinion regarding Item 3, Thunderclap, on the evening of the 20th, since extensive inquiries are necessary. Schultz had no argument. Your opinion entirely agrees with ours. Schmidt, too, seemed satisfied. Okay, no further questions. After a brief discussion of Sixth Army's most pressing supply needs, Schultz signed off. I have nothing else, and I wish you all the best. Heil und Sieg. 125 miles to the northwest, where the second Russian offensive was aimed at Italian forces along the upper reaches of the Don, orderlies at a field hospital ran through the halls, screaming that the Russians had broken through and were just 200 meters away. No orders were issued to retreat. None were needed. Loading his patients on trucks, Dr. Cristoforo Capone and his medical assistant hitched a ride on one of the vehicles, which navigated the snow-laden road at 3 miles an hour. When mortar shells bracketed them on both sides, Capone jumped out and rolled into a drift. In the next instant, the truck exploded, blowing huge pieces of metal into the sky and killing Capone's assistant. His mind in a ferment, the doctor wandered away from the crackling flames. Only hours before, he had been prepared to leave for a Christmas furlough in Italy. Now he walked through a nightmare of dead and dying, and the living, who jostled past him with curses on their lips. The Italian Eighth Army had broken and run. Unaware of this new disaster, the 6th Panzer Division, speeding toward the Kessel, entered a village on the south side of the Mishkova River. In the pre-dawn light of December 20th, someone spied a Russian staff car racing toward the still undamaged bridge leading to Vasilevska on the northern bank. A helmeted Russian officer was crouching low in the back seat of the automobile, and before anyone could stop him, the car sped over the river to safety. But the Russians had made a grievous error. They failed to blow the span, and the German panzers rumbled into Vasilevska just before first light. They immediately formed a hedgehog defense to wait for supply trucks with ammunition and gasoline to catch up with them. To their front, the entire Soviet Second Guards Army was deployed across the route to Stalingrad, and while scouts of the 6th Panzer Division watched the rear for some sign of the desperately needed supplies, the Russians began to push them back. A pessimistic German officer approved the morning's report. War Diary, Tank Regiment 11, Vasilevska, December 20th, 0600 hours. The gradually increasing resistance is becoming stronger every hour. Our weak troops, 21 tanks without gasoline, and 2 weak assault gun companies, are insufficient to widen the bridgehead. Along the Upper Don, the sun rose on a ghastly scene. The bitter cold had claimed thousands of Italian soldiers who paused to sleep during the night. These victims now sat by the roads in what appeared to be comfortable positions, like bored spectators at a Roman arena, as their countrymen scurried by. Giant snowflakes began to collect on their coats and faces. Soon they were covered completely. The corpses became road markers for the living. Cristoforo Capone walked past them in a daze. Still numbed by the thought that he had barely missed his flight to freedom, he tried to grapple with the reality of the situation. The cries of a wounded soldier stopped him. Without any medical supplies, the doctor cupped the boy's head in his hands and looked sorrowfully into his eyes. "My son, I can do nothing for you," he said softly. "You must be brave." As the boy stared back, a shell splinter cut off the top of his head, spraying brains and blood over the doctor's face and uniform. For several long seconds, Capone held tightly to the crimson-gray mask in his hands. Then the boy sagged onto the ground. Capone collapsed beside him and threw up. When the nausea passed, the doctor rose weakly. Grazing a solid object with his hand, he grasped a bag of sugar that somehow had been hidden in the snow. Suddenly, ravenously hungry, he began to stuff handfuls of the delicacy into his mouth. While the Italian Eighth Army collapsed, the teleprinter at Gumrak produced another frenzy of words. 20th December, 42, afternoon. Here is General Schultz. Here is General Schmidt. Hello, Schultz. 1. As a result of the casualties of the recent days, the troop situation on the West Front and in the city of Stalingrad has become extremely tense. Penetrations can only be repulsed by those forces which are to be committed for Operation Winter Storm, Link-Up. In case of major breakthroughs, we must have the Army reserves, and in particular the tanks, at our disposal. So far, the Army tanks had to be committed on the West Front every second or third day, as a fire brigade, so to speak. This means, as was reported yesterday, that if stronger forces of the Army advance too far away from the fortress, it becomes doubtful whether the fortress itself can be held. The start of the attack will therefore depend on how far 6th Panzer Division will presumably advance. However, the Army Group may rest assured that we shall not take a one-sided view of the situation and that we shall not act selfishly. Still, we again request that we may not be ordered to form up until it is certain that Hoth's operational units will reach the area around Buzanovka. In this connection, more detailed and continual information on the situation with Hoth would be particularly important to us. 2. The situation would be somewhat different if it were certain that winter storm would be immediately followed by thunderclap, total withdrawal. In this case, we might put up with local penetrations on the other fronts, provided they do not endanger the retreat of the Army as a whole. We would then be much stronger for the breakthrough toward the south, because we could concentrate numerous local reserves from all fronts in the south. It would therefore be essential for the Army to learn in time whether thunderclap is still intended. 3. In case Operation Thunderclap is put into practice, it is necessary that A. Part of the 8,000 wounded men who are still here at present are taken out by air. We have an additional 500 to 600 casualties per day, so that if 1,000 wounded men were taken out daily, 6 to 8 days would suffice to evacuate about half of them. The balance might be evacuated by truck or by air during the operation. 4. If we form up for winter storm, it must also